Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. Happy to be joined for a poll release podcast by my friend and colleague, Darren Shaw.
Hello.
Professor of Government at the University of Texas at Austin. Thanks for making it, Darren.
Always a pleasure.
And Josh Blank, Research Director of the Texas Politics Project and also friend and colleague, just coming off a big birthday.
That's true. Big birthday.
25.
Following up on Josh being able to drink legally now. Which is a relief.
I was going to say, maybe we're going to say.
At this point.
Yeah, especially for you.
cuts down on the anxiety, yes. We're joined here today. No, we're not getting married, but we're joined together today here temporarily.
Yeah. A yoking,
for our customary discussion of the latest UT Texas Politics Project poll, which was conducted May 31st to June 9th. So as it turned out, we started data collection the afternoon after Donald Trump's conviction was handed down by a New York jury. And, I think we'll have some occasion to talk about that timing and dilemmas it presented us, et cetera. But today, as always, we'll focus mostly on our election-related results. We've got Darren here with us. A little less than 5 months from Election Day, and a bit closer than that, of course, to the opening of early voting. So, you know, thing that gets the most attention are these trial ballots. Let's start with us. Josh, why don't you give us a rundown of what we found in the presidential race trial ballots we did?
Yeah, sure. So we asked this two ways. We asked a head-to-head matchup between Donald Trump and Joe Biden, partially just for trend and to be able to make comparisons across time and space a little bit more easily. And then we also ask a multi-candidate item that includes Jill Stein, Cornel West, and of course, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. In the two-way trial ballot, Trump led Biden by 7 points, 46-39%. This is pretty much comparable to where he was in April polling when he led 48-40. In February, he was at 48-41. So this 7 to 8 point lead has been pretty durable throughout much of 2023 and 2024. When we look at the multi-candidate race, what we find is Trump leading by a slightly larger margin, 9 points, 43-34%. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. comes in at 8% in this poll, the same place he was in April. And these numbers are also, you know, relatively durable. And obviously, you know, the context of that automatically kind of brings up in some ways is the trial and whether it had an impact or not. And I think we'll sort of, to open up the discussion, I'll say, you know, these sort of top line numbers, although not very different, hide some movement under the surface for sure.
Right, right. I want to, you know, I think another thing that's interesting to me about this that, you know, Josh and you and I were chatting about this last night, and Darren, I've seen this, is that, you know, I was going back and updating our poll tracker that we maintain at the website that is all the state polling, not just ours.
Yeah.
And there is an interesting, you know, slowly closing, I mean, I wouldn't bet the house on it, gap between Biden and Trump. In other words, if we look early this year, you know, there was a lot of polling in the low double figures.
Right.
Now we're kind of in the mid to high single figures. Now I don't expect the slope to continue, but you know, we've been saying for months we expected, as people paid more attention, we'd see some change in this race, right?
Yeah, and you know, I'll point to a set of questions that Jim and Joss have championed and that you guys can find on this poll. That's trade evaluations. Trump is essentially flatlined since, I believe we asked these in December.
Yeah.
2023, Josh? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And Trump is essentially the same. When I say traits, I'm asking about, you know, honest and trustworthy, you know, strong leader. And in this particular matchup, we've added a few.
Competent, age.
Right. The age one,
yeah.
You know, in particular is relevant to this particular matchup in a way that it might not have been relevant with Romney and Obama or something like that. But if you look at the numbers, Trump is basically flatlined. So it's not like Trump has really lost much, but Biden is ticked up just a little bit.
And by flatline, you mean he's steady, right?
Steady, exactly. Yeah. That is the percentage.
Context, right.
Yeah, exactly. The percentage of people who say that a particular trait describes him or that he possesses a certain trait has basically been the same. With Biden, the positive trait evaluations have ticked up slightly.
Yeah.
And in particular, I think the one that's kind of fat is not a great number, but, you know, 69% in December said he's told to be president in 2025. And the number is 64 now. Now, so the net, I'm trying to help my man here. The net was minus 47 on that trait. That is 69% said he's too old. 22% said, no, he's not too old in December, right? So again, minus 47. And now that number is, minus 36. You know, it's 64 say, yes, he's too old, 28%. So about, 5-6 points on either side of that. Again, not great, but if you look at the tabs, what you'll see is these are Democrats coming home. And I've seen this in the UT poll as well as in some of the national polls I've been involved with. Biden's ratings are not necessarily – his job handling numbers are not necessarily improving. But his issue handling and trait evaluations are improving, but they're almost entirely improving as a function of Democrats coming home.
And but that speaks directly to one of the big narratives out there, not that we follow media narratives, but that Biden was having trouble, securing his base.
Yeah. And I think so there's a
doesn't mean the problem's solved.
Right.
But.
There's a question in political science, obviously, and we always in political science come down, at least recently, on the side of voters will adjust their issue and trait perceptions to conform with their vote preference, right? So once I realize I'm voting for Biden, suddenly he's not too old. Suddenly he's much better on border security. Did I say he was weak on border security? What I meant was he's okay on border security.
I like his steady hand on Israel.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So I think... And I don't want to overplay this, but you're seeing a little bit of that. And I think it's a mixed bag. On the one hand, yes, I think it's Democrats consolidating. That's good for Biden. On the other hand, let's not, jump off a cliff. This isn't Republicans or, more importantly, independents who have suddenly decided, that executive order, he's, Normandy, and he's great on these things. It's just, a little less bad, mostly driven by partisans coming home.
Yeah, I mean, predictable in some ways, right?
Yeah, and maybe a little earlier than...
That's what I was going to ask. Yeah. I mean, if you're thinking about, you're saying, he's consolidating his support. But one of the weird things to me, just, in the conversations I've had, especially with reporters, but just generally, is this idea that here we are, May, June, this race is fixed. Everybody knows these guys. It's all set. And so whatever we see and I notice this as a pollster, and it's interesting, these sort of two points. One, which is that everybody's taking every number that we put out. I mean, not like, trying to say, look at us, I'm brushing my shoulder off here, but everybody, I'm thinking like pollsters, everybody's taking every number that pollsters put out is like, this is some sort of fixed thing. Biden's got a problem with 18 to 29 year olds. Biden's got a problem with Hispanics. Now, if you're looking across multiple polls and seeing that, there's no reason not to think that that's right. But the other side of this is to say, as a pollster, I'm looking at his numbers in May and June of 2024 among a cell size that maybe has 100 respondents, maybe 200 respondents, right, in a pretty big margin of error. And I'm looking at the same results from 2020, and they're not really terribly different.
That's a really good point, Josh. I mean, I did this because – let's be clear.
Biden, I'm not saying I don't disagree with you.
Yeah, no, and in fact –
there's a second point I should follow, but go ahead, please.
Because I'm open to this as well, which is when you see numbers like – Trump at 25% with African-American supporters, or 44% with Latinos, or, 45% with people under 30 years of age. You got two potential reactions. The first is, I don't believe these numbers.
Right.
There's,
Right.
But as Josh points out, we've seen them so consistently across both national and state polls, and we've certainly seen them in our poll. So the second thing is, okay, just because I believe them today,
right,
does that really mean that, Trump's going to draw 45% of Hispanic voters in November. And that is an absolutely open question. And I think what we're seeing a little bit of is maybe not, and as Josh pointed out, I looked at the numbers with African-Americans. Trump was drawing in the high teens with African-American voters at this point in 2020, and he ended up getting in the high single digits.
Right.
So are people going to come home? And now that's still an issue. Here's where we might differ, but Josh and I in particular might differ with our colleagues in political science. I don't think it's a foreordained thing. I think the Biden camp is saying, like, well, it's going to happen. And my response is maybe, unless you screw up.
Yeah. Right.
I mean,
it becomes a self-fulfilling I mean, the Biden campaign has theoretically the wherewithal to make it a little bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy. They can say, well, they'll come home, but they can also say, because we're, you know, about to unleash a massive bout of spending to try and make that, you know, induce that outcome.
Right.
But one other sort of, just to follow this up then, I think the other key here, just as, you know, people who do this and follow this so closely, is that even if we do see a, you know, mass coming home, or even if we see something that we would consider a mass movement in this election, what are we talking about here?
Yeah.
Like 4 points?
Well, yeah. Well, we're let's without completely losing that, let's do the math. If there's 13% of your estimated electorate is Hispanic, and you're talking about the difference between
African American,
we're actually up to 12% Hispanic international samples, and we've dropped.
Oh, now you're talking nationally.
Yeah, and we've dropped African Americans down to 12% actually. Now in the Texas area, you're talking about Hispanic population.
Yeah, that's why I was
in the mid to high 20s.
Yeah,
and, right. But all right. Well, let's take the
myopic.
Texas. Yeah, let's take the Texas poll, right? Where you've got let's just for
all I see is Texas. Purposes.
Yeah, let's say a quarter of our estimated electorate is Hispanic, and so we're talking about movement of, let's say, instead of getting 30%, Trump gets 40%. So that's 0.1 off of 0.25. So that's 2.5 points. Now that's a big deal, but that's maximum movement amongst a big group.
And there's two things here also, and just to add to that. That would be a big deal,
right?
And that would be maximum movement across a large group, and it would account for about 2.5 points in the race. But also, we're talking about a group that if anybody, again, when we say this all the time, if anybody's out here telling you exactly what Hispanics are doing right now, you say, how many Hispanics are in your poll? And we're part of this too, and that's why I want to say clearly, right? This is why we should expect to see A, some bouncing around, but B, I mean, this kind of reminds me of some work we've done in the past, and it reminds me of some of the limitations of social science methods, which is like, you know, ultimately what you're really – everything is kind of based on is it zero or not, and a lot of times. You're saying is it bigger than zero or not is what we're talking about. When you're talking about movements of 2 points, 3 points in that sort of neighborhood, and you have a sample of 200 people, you know, again, a subsample that you're trying to make comparison, you know, we're just not very good at telling you whether there's actually differences, whether there's actually movement, that we just don't have like the power, you know?
I think one of the things just to, again, look under the hood is when you see a poll like we were saying, like Jim prefaces properly by saying like, yeah, it's, you know, a couple points maybe moving back, but it's moving to a place where we find the storylines plausible, right? Mm-hmm. So rather than winning by, you know, 12, 13, 14, we're talking about Trump, you know, maybe in the 7 point. 7 to 9 point range.
And
okay.
that's the key. And you see that. And the key here is, you know, that doesn't necessarily make itself totally apparent in one poll or in one survey result across multiple polls. Where you start to see that is when you dig into these results and you start to see where there is movements in groups and where it makes sense, right? As you said, Democrats coming home makes a lot of sense because they're not voting for Trump.
But I think it's the larger point, though, still right, which is, okay, so we've got movement, small movement, margin of error type movement. But it conforms with our expectations.
Yeah, seems to be still, in the direction we would expect.
But we still need to, you know, pour a little bit of salt on it and say, okay, but it's possible we're going to be telling you a contrary story in our July podcast. You know, that, well, it's actually 12 points and, you know, that's plausible.
So along, within this theme, so let's turn this like, you know, just 90 degrees a little bit and say, okay, so we're talking about these shifts of 2-3 points here and there. I think you can see a little bit of that, but in an interesting way, in the questions that we asked about people's views of Trump's conviction and their own account of its impact on their vote.
Right.
Right. So what do we make of that? So Josh, tell us what we got on that.
Sure.
And we can.
So first and foremost, we ask people, you know,
I'm holding Darren back from the mic right now.
Okay. I'm just going to run through real quick. I'm going to give you 6 results total across the two items,
Oh,
right?
Look at this.
So thinking about the felony convictions of Donald Trump by a New York jury for falsifying business records, do you think Donald Trump received a fair trial? 48% of Texas voters said yes, he received a fair trial. 40% said no. 12% didn't have an opinion. Among Democrats, 87% thought he received a fair trial. 75% of Republicans thought he did not. 14% thought he did. independents were split, but on the side of a fair trial, 44-34. I'm adding two for the independents, I decided. Then we also asked people, I can make choices. Then we also asked people, does Donald Trump's conviction make you more or less likely to support him in the 2024 presidential election? We agonized over this. Maybe we'll talk about it. I don't know. And we allowed people to say it made them much more likely, somewhat more likely, has no impact on their support, somewhat less likely, much less likely. Overall, 36% of voters said it made them more likely, 27% less. It's obviously only interesting among partisans. Democrats, 51% said it made them less likely. About a third said it made no impact. Among Republicans, 62% said his conviction made them more likely to vote for him, including 50% who said it made them much more likely. So there's...
And here's where I'm going to pause and say you can follow along at home since Josh so effectively ran through a lot of data quickly. If you go to texaspolitics.utexas.edu, there's a link in the kind of the marquee box on the page. You go to the blog section or to our data archive. You can download all of these results, follow along at home. So
the key,
Darren Shaw.
For me, the key is the one number that Josh pointed out, which is more likely 36, less likely 27.
Yeah.
So, a 9-point. So apparently getting convicted of a felony is really good politics if you're a Republican running for president of the state of Texas. Now, I think, again, and I agree with the decision to ask everybody, because what we could have done clearly is ask people who don't have a preference, right? Because when people say, do I really care if somebody who's already strongly supporting Trump says now they're more likely to support Trump? Right?
And I should say, among the people who don't have an opinion said someone else, much, much more likely to say they were much less likely.
Right.
Support him, right?
Right. So but what's the less likely number goes up.
But what's the denominator?
Oh, it's time. Well, again, this goes back to the math, right?
Right. Yeah, that's
what
I mean.
And also, you have to think about who are the people watching this race right now who have no opinion between Trump and Biden, and are they likely to turn out in November? And I would say their turnout likelihood is probably lower than the other people, right?
Well, that's why this is – and you see just the fumbling on the part of pollsters and analysts to deal with – when asked a question about the impact of this, and I've had it from my bosses at Fox who say, well, what's the bottom line? What can we say about it? And they do not want a 12-minute soliloquy on this. But
this is like the conversation we had.
That's right.
Someone's going to say, well, what does this mean?
What does this mean?
What did it do?
And it just a couple of observations. One is the previous question we asked: how much have you been paying attention to a set of political news events and issues? And the one striking finding is that 69% said they'd been paying a lot of attention to the Trump trial and the Trump convention.
Yeah.
That blows everything else out of the water, right? We had a question about how much attention you've been paying to the conflict between Texas and the federal government over immigration. That's 55%. We had a question about abortion access, how much it did, 44. So we're talking about, 14 points, 20 points. In some cases, 50 points higher. The poor orphan here is the results of the runoff in the district of Representative Dade Phelan, Speaker of the Texas House. 14% said they've been paying a lot of attention to that.
I think I know all of those people.
Yeah. Exactly.
Right. Compared to 69%. So then you get to the actual reaction numbers. So ton of people paying attention, and mostly through a partisan filter.
Yeah.
Which is... I think a reasonable storyline. I would say, though, it's probably useful to take those things in tandem, which is if I'm in the Biden campaign, would I rather the ambient conversation be focusing on my age, my mental acuity, or would I rather the ambient conversation be about, whether or not Trump is really a felon or not? I think it's a
pretty easy question to answer if you're in the Biden campaign.
Exactly. I think it's just a much better. So, I think, yes, it's appropriate to focus on shifts in the ballot and to try to figure out what's driving that. I think it's appropriate to look at the actual, people's responses to how it affects them. That's why we do polls. We want the response to that question. But if you're asking Jim and Josh and I here kind of what we're making of this, I think it's a shift in the conversation that's very welcome for the Democrats. They want a conversation about honesty and trustworthiness. And, I think this is an editorial comment. Their handling of the Hunter Biden episode in the wake of the Trump conviction struck me as being something they've handled probably better than almost anything else they've handled in this cycle, right? Which people like us were going, what are they going to do? How are they going to deal? Are they going to be hypocrite? And basically, it's just like, nah, you know.
Guess he's going to jail.
The justice system. No man's above the law. The justice system is sacrosanct. It's like, whoa, okay.
You know what's interesting?
Dealt with that problem.
Yeah. You know what's interesting about that, Darren, though, and I don't want to get us too far down this path, but is that 10 years ago, I think that would have been an obvious response.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right? We'd have gone, well, of course he's not going to pardon his son.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah. I actually thought that they would draw a distinction between pardoning and commuting the sentence, which would have been, you know, dust off this verb, Clintonian, adjective, I should say.
Yeah, and I just think that's not.
And they didn't.
It's funny. I was not particularly, you know, I was not particularly surprised by this. I mean, I think they were going to have trouble doing anything here, and it's just too
hard
on that.
But I think, again, not to get too far paced, but they like the focus being on Trump and defending the jury system and judges and things like that. And they're quite content with that. And they've said all along they want this to be a choice between them and Trump. And, you know, so it's probably works slightly to their advantage, even if the numbers haven't shifted all that much.
Yeah. I mean, I want to go back to the nature, just one more beat to the nature of the question and our own internal debates over it.
Me
and
too,
because,
so good.
I know you do, Josh. And I think that one of the,
I'm the one holding.
This time it's you with the hook. Yeah. I was talking to a reporter about this that we gave in advance a couple of days ago, about this and just kind of landed on, I think you can't be too trapped by your expectations going into something like this from our perspective, because even though it is hard to explain, to me, it's worthwhile to be able to just kind of say, look, this doesn't illustrate what some people thought it would illustrate, that it would change a bunch of people's minds. That it was, it's essentially, grounds what, the reasonable expectation that it was confirmatory of people's pre-existing beliefs in most cases, and particularly in the case of partisans. And that tells us something, and again, have to explain it, but, I think is the more we have, from our perspective, the more we have to explain it, theoretically anyway, the better we get at it. You were deeply ambivalent about this going, not deeply, but I think you were ambivalent about this going on.
I was deeply ambivalent. I think that's fair. I mean, so I was deeply ambivalent because, one, people are very bad at describing the reasons for their own behavior. And the idea of asking people to describe their reasons for their future behavior seems even more problematic, right? Like most people who are going to vote for Donald Trump are Republicans who would have voted for almost any qualified Republican nominee for president, most Democrats likewise. So like, the idea that this really fundamentally changed people's decisions, most people's, is, I just think, not true. Yet it's still worth asking about. And so the why for me that it was still worth it is because I wanted to see, especially, on the Republican side and among independents and some other key groups, how many people were willing to say, no, this is a problem for me. Like this, because we've been asking this a lot about the liabilities of each candidate. We ask a question about, the nature of the support of each candidate. And we saw almost 3/4 of Republican voters saying they're voting for Donald Trump as opposed to against Joe Biden, right? And likewise, we saw a much more mixed Democratic electorate and we look to the nature of their votes. So this is something we've been exploring for a while. So you do want to see what is the share of, Republicans for whom this is a problem. And it is meaningful at 14%. Like, that's a lot of Republicans. But it doesn't really manifest itself. And then this kind of comes back to this other discussion we've been having all along about, the way this may have impacted things, which it is about the ambient message. I mean, one of the things that's notable is that, Donald Trump in the last 2 polls in Texas has polled pretty well among under 30 and among Hispanic voters, which has been a lot of the discussion and sort of consternation among Democrats, and it flipped back in this poll. Now, that could have happened for a million reasons. When I say flipped back, I mean flipped back to kind of where the numbers were through much of 2023 and prior. So they're familiar, but it puts Biden in a better position. Is that because something fundamentally happened in that period? Is that the data kind of, mixing back and the sample just kind of moving, just the nature of sampling? Maybe. It's also the case that, if all you're hearing is convicted felon, convicted felon, convicted felon. Like for those people who are, ambiently aware of what's going on, and to your point, the biggest political story right now is still his legal problems and this trial and everything else. Maybe that's just enough to move to sort of explain some of that movement. So worth checking in on. I mean, the thing that's interesting, I think, to me also is what effect time has on this, right? I mean, we were in the field. Literally, we were already going to go in the field the Friday. The conviction was Thursday. we're going to the field Friday. We did this. To the extent that the Biden campaign, you know, throughout basically from now until, you know, November is saying, can you put a convicted felon in the White House? He's a convicted felon, the convicted former president, the felon, over and over and over again. This could have more of an effect than we're picking up right now. But I do think that everything we've talked about here says it's still going to be in this limited range, right?
Right. And if you look at the fave-unfave, I mean, that's one of the things, you know, we were interested in. You know, I don't have it right in front of me, but I think Biden's favorable, you know, I think Trump's favorables among Democrats or, you know, his numbers got about 2 or 3 points more negative. Among Republicans, he got about 2 or 3% more positive.
Yeah.
Makes all the sense in the world to me, to the degree that that even comes out in the wash, given our MOE.
Well, and right? The other thing just to say is, like, none of this reflects well on Biden in any direct way. So there's no reason that Trump's conviction means that Biden's numbers, like the underlying numbers, favorability.
That's Trump's
numbers. None of that stuff should matter. But that also goes to this where we started, which is I think that if nothing else, all this has done is kind of accelerated the start of the campaign a little bit. It's reminded some Democrats, oh, yeah, this guy. Right. And so you're seeing them move back. You're seeing some young voters move back, some Hispanics move back, but not in some sort of direction that would go and change, again, the trial ballots or really change the fundamental, like, you know, orientation of the race so far. But it just kind of puts Democrats back where they were before there was a little bit of uptick in the numbers for Trump and other Republicans kind of in the beginning of this year.
Yeah. Quick observation as we close this out. But the first is the next thing is the sentencing. So people who were waiting on this with bated breath are now saying, well, the sentencing, though, is going to be, you know, that's going to be the big deal. And, you know, okay, maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
I also think this is a side note that it would be, you know, legal malpractice for the Trump team to allow that to actually get to sentencing. There's a whole series of grounds by which.
Yeah.
But that's sort of the small point. The sort of larger point is what I've seen in a lot of the national numbers I've been running is that the two campaigns have very different strategic imperatives. The Biden team's imperative is to convince people that he has been a good steward of the country for 4 years. His whole claim was a return to normalcy, stop the craziness. And it's a president that's presided over, you know, record-setting inflation, two new foreign conflicts, a crisis at the border. And I think his imperative is to go out and tell voters a story that assures them, like, no, these are okay. We've got it under control. And by the way, this is the editorial note saying that we've already fixed the economy is probably not the best way to do that. But
yeah,
the Trump team's problem is completely different. The Trump team's problem is that people think he's got a big mouth, that he talks too much, that he's divisive, and that's something he needs to do better on. And this is a problem for that. That is these numbers about the conviction. I think a lot of people go, oh my gosh, here we go again. You know, he's on trial, for goodness sake, you know, because of this business stuff. He can't, you know, and I think people who remember the fatigue, you know, so I think both sides have very different things they need to accomplish. And I think this makes the Trump task a little more difficult than it was. And by the way, the functional expression of that is that people think, and I think I agree with this, that there's a kind of an upper limit to what Trump can get in, you know, nationally. He bumps up against 47-48%. And he never really gets above that.
Yeah.
He's cracked 50 in a couple polls, but it's really a problem. And Josh, I think that ceiling got harder with the conviction. In a state like Texas, that, I don't know, what would you guys say that upper limit is? 51 maybe, something like that? But
but you know, he hasn't even hit that. I don't think.
Yeah. You know what he's not getting?
He's been in the high 40s.
Yeah, you know what he's not getting is 55.
Right.
And in a state like Texas, that's something that a popular Republican can aspire to do. And Trump is nowhere near there.
Right. I think that's right.
I want to add just one thing, just a separate point just from this data, because I thought it was interesting. It's been really popular in the national discussion lately about the role of sort of more and less engaged voters and the idea that, you know, Trump is relying on, you know, in the polling, his, you know, to the extent he's doing well, it's based on sort of the opinions of less engaged voters. And I'll just say in Texas, that does not repeat itself unless your only definition of engagement is education level. But that obviously sort of picks up reinforcements and party identification. So you tend to see, you know, more educated voters tend to be lean more towards Biden than Trump. But across the other items that we do, that we ask to assess engagement, interest, and participation rates, Trump's leads are actually the biggest amongst the most engaged voters in Texas. And so, and they actually tend to decline as you go down to the less engaged. So, you know, that's an interesting story. I was wondering, does that repeat here? There's been just gotten a lot of news lately. You know, I think a lot of Democrats are like, wait, you know, wait, it's okay. It's like, well, maybe not here.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry. I want to throw that out.
No, I think that's good. So let's talk at least a little bit about the U.S. Senate race between incumbent Ted Cruz, Democratic challenger Congressman Colin Allred. Tell us about the numbers in that race, Josh, and let's see what we think.
Yeah, sure. So in this most recent survey, Cruz led Allred 45% to 34%, so an 11-point lead. This is, you know, pretty close to where he was in the last poll. It was 46-33. It was 46-32 before that. So we've been in a pretty steady state up until this point in that race. You know, I can go into some of the other numbers if you want, just real quick.
I think on one hand, I think this race is kind of self-explanatory. On the other hand, I think that there are, you know, hopeful Democrats out there that are kind of looking at this and thinking, you know, this cannot be a double-digit race, you know, right? But I think there's kind of obvious explanations for that to my mind.
Yeah, it's a – look, we've got Cruz at 45%. That's not a good number for an incumbent at this stage. Certainly not incumbent with Cruz's reputation and name recognition in the state. 14% undecided, 6% other. You know, he's chasing 9 points, so let's be realistic. On the other hand, I don't think this is a terrible poll for Allred. You know, and I think the, as we've talked about many times before, it continues to be a problem of getting on the map and, you know, just breaking through, you know, the noise about Trump and Biden and that conversation. But you know, what we're showing in the generic ballots, so for state ledge and for U.S. House, is about a 5-point Republican lead with lots of people basically saying, you know, we don't know yet.
Yeah.
So with all the incumbency, with having run for president and everything, Cruz is basically a point better than that against a guy who remains at this point basically a generic Democrat. I'm not sure that's great news for Cruz at this point, which I think you were kind of hinting at.
I agree with most of that.
Yeah.
I agree with most of that.
Nine points is 9 points. Let me be clear.
Yeah.
But I also think, you know, on one hand, Allred has, you know, has room to grow. I mean, Josh and I were talking about the internals and he's not, you know, he's not doing appreciably worse than Beto O'Rourke was in 2018, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's sort of the interesting thing we kind of keep going back to. And it's, you know, because that was the high watermark for Democrats, you know, whether that's because of O'Rourke's candidacy or the environment, doesn't really matter.
Reasonable people can disagree.
But for the point of the comparison, it doesn't make a difference, right? Because in terms of fave, unfave, in June of 2018, O'Rourke was 37 fave, 24 unfave. Allred's 34 fave, 24 unfave. So he's literally 3 points off. I mean, within the margin almost of where that's overall. So he's not within the, well, it is within the margin of where Cruz was, or I'm sorry, where O'Rourke was during that race. And so, you know, we're, and Jim and I are talking about this a little bit this morning about how, like, you know, you can kind of hold these two things that are contradictory but true, which is on the one hand, Allred's doing fine. Like, I mean, if we just take a step back and say it's June, he's got the rest of the summer, he's going to have a, you know,
enough money.
He's going to have close to $100 million probably to spend, you know, whatever. Maybe he'll get some money from outside groups. But, like, you know, he's not in a bad place. At the same time, it doesn't change the fact that Democrats haven't won a race in Texas in 2+ decades.
It's a good question about what your standards are.
I mean,
you know, if the standards are winning and maybe, you know, maybe keeping the Senate blue, I'm not so sure how much enthusiasm I'd have. But if you're talking about the potential for a race that's under 5 points – And that attracts a lot of attention in late September and early October.
Right.
I'm looking at this going, and we come back to the fact that there's only two potential Democratic targets really at this point in the Senate, given the skewed nature of the map. There's so many Democrats who won in 2018 who are defending this time around.
Democrats have a lot more exposure than Republicans this cycle in the U.S.
So you're
Senate.
So you're looking at Texas and Florida. You know, Rick Scott and Ted Cruz is the obvious targets. And I think we might have mentioned this last time, but honestly, if I were a Democrat looking at these data and said, and someone asked me, you've only got money for one race, would you go on the offense in Florida or Texas? I think I choose Texas at this point. Again, a long shot, but
If you're looking at the trend lines, one's going away from you and one's going towards you.
Yeah,
potentially at least.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, from a strategic point of view, if you're the Allred campaign, you're just trying to get close enough that when And, you know, we have to remember that, you know, it won't be just them fighting for Democratic money, whether it's Florida or Texas, because they're playing defense.
Defense,
you know,
in so many places. You know,
John Tester's going to have a lot of claim on some of that money.
Well, heck, even Maryland now.
Right, exactly. So, but I mean, I think what I said last time is that all red is just starting from a pretty, low benchmark position here.
Yeah.
And because they haven't made up all the ground yet, they've made up a little incremental ground. You know, if you look back at his favorability ratings going back, you know, 3-4 polls since we've been asking, maybe even a few more than that, you know, he's inching up.
He hasn't done much with Dem. He hasn't done it. I mean, look, and this, I don't want to say like, and there's no normative statement here. It's just an observation of the facts. He hasn't seen much movement with Democrats since claiming the nomination. He got up to a certain percentage. He sort of sat there at about 54 fave, I think, among Democrats along those lines, as I recall, something like that. He's kind of sat there for a few polls. Now, I mean, I think
that's with some still like something like 30% with no opinion of him.
Right. And that's the thing. And I think, you know, you kind of get this mixed sort of thing. I think you've got certain sort of Democrats who either don't believe it or sort of feel like he should have been spending tens of millions of dollars, you know, during the last couple of months. And then you talk to some professional Democrats, or at least I have, who are just kind of like, yeah, he's in trouble, you know, and kind of like it doesn't matter. But the other side of this, too, is, you know, campaigns have limited resources, right? Like, this is not the time to be doing this.
And to Darren's point, you know, you're in trouble, but, you know, how much trouble? And, you know, when does it make sense to start addressing the obvious issue? And I think there's a reasonable argument to be made that, you know, you plug away, and then after your party's convention, you know, you start spending more money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think a couple of interesting things that are, you know, first is that Cruz, we had noted, I think, in the February and the April polls that Cruz's favorability, or I should say his job approval, his job approval, had ticked up, and it ticked up kind of appreciably. He'd gone from kind of net negative ratings last year, and he ticked up to barely positive, 2 or 3 points approve over disapprove, his job handling in the fall polls that we conducted. But in the spring polls, and here I'm referring to the February and then the April poll, he was up, he was plus 9 and plus 11, which is as high as we've had Cruz on his job ratings.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's down to plus 3, and it's mostly, you know, Democrats, I think, and independents. But that's slightly encouraging. I do think if you talk to Republicans and you talk to the Cruz people in particular, I think they're very concerned just about Republican infrastructure in the state of Texas.
Yeah.
That they just don't think that the blocking and tackling that needs to happen is being done. They're concerned about not capitalizing on potential in the RGV, you know, with Hispanic voters. And it's odd, you know, on the one hand, they almost want a competitive race to do the things they think they need to do because let's just briefly game plan this out. Let's say Trump wins and the Republicans take the House and the Senate. I think there's an argument to be made that Republicans will be in Texas will be extremely vulnerable in 2026.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, you look race by race at that state house and a normal kind of average, you know, ebb in the in-party's vote could make them very vulnerable. Yeah. I know smart Republicans are thinking about
a little more
in
Texas pressure than they're used to, at the very least.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's interesting. I mean, I think that makes sense.
And to some of your, you know, the points you guys are making, just to throw the numbers out there, you know, his favorability numbers now compared to June of 2018 are essentially unchanged.
Yeah.
You know, he was basically, I think, plus 1 or 0 net favorability in 2018, and he's 44 fave, 44 unfave in this poll. So he hasn't really done anything to, I mean, he's been trying, you know, mightily to sort of, you know, burnish his bipartisan credentials.
I think we talked about this last time. It's been a very concerted effort by the Cruz campaign and I think, you know, the Cruz Senate office to reposition him a little bit.
Right.
A couple of, you know, high profile efforts to work on bipartisan legislation and to really, and they really promoted that.
Yeah. Well, air traffic controllers.
Yeah. Yeah.
There we go. I remember it.
I know it's a small thing, but Fox News runs this thing with Brett Baer on Special Report called Common Ground, in which they have a Republican and Democrat talk about the things they're doing. And Cruz has been on that, and I believe more than once. You know,
yeah, so. Right. I think that's a beautiful example, I think, and, you know, and not the only one. I mean, you know, his appearance at the Texas Tribune Festival last fall, which I saw part of, I think it was being interviewed by Patrick Svitek, I think. you know, was a, you know, a much, I don't want to say kindler, gentler, that's too unkind or, you know, a little too extreme, a much more modulated Ted Cruz.
Yeah. You wonder if he's moving almost into, you know, I think he's more ambitious than this, but almost into Ted Kennedy status, right? Where maybe my future.
You heard it here first.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Ted Cruz like Ted Kennedy from
moving to
Professor
the lion.
Darren
he wants to be the new lion of the Senate. I don't believe that, but I think
that's
it's
a highlight.
It's, but it's worth kind of.
Spit yeah. take two.
You know, and I, you know, I, we, before we close out, I want to do one. You know, it's in, you know, your report about concerns about Republican blocking and tackling, I think is very interesting, Darren, because I, you know, as we were thinking about this and I was thinking of, you know, doing the various write-ups and taking notes and thinking it through, I was thinking a bit about the transition from the very tumultuous year we've seen at state level, state and below state level Republican politics in Texas in the last year, and thinking about the transition to a more broadly speaking kind of reunified approach in the general election. And I am wondering, you know, it feels to me like most of the internal kind of communication, messaging, exchanges that we're seeing, you know, amongst Republican stakeholders, activists, officials in Texas has been still as much more about colliding with each other internally than it is about the upcoming general election.
Right. Even the... You know, the dispute over chair of the RPT, which the kind of contentious Republican back and forth over who was going to be the chair of the Republican Party in the state of Texas, you know, involved this disparate set of factors. I mean, I think the Abbott people largely sat it out, but the Paxton people and the Patrick people were involved, and everybody wanted to get Trump's endorsement, but the Trump people had also, you know, and then there are Trump donors who were involved,
right.
And some people, when I say involved, I mean some people were, some people said they wouldn't be involved, which is actually a statement of involvement sometimes.
Yeah, right.
And I don't know that what they actually had was a serious conversation about who would best lead the party forward in the election. Instead, it was about various factions competing.
Yeah, and I think in terms of also a
well, that won. I mean, that argument won, basically.
A kind of, yeah. But also, I think the, just in a very practical kind of way, a lot of energy, resources, effort went into the extended runoff season in the legislature. And that was, you know, I mean, it was both the intensity of those fights and the scope of them, because there were so many races.
Yeah.
And then I think, you know, the primaries were over and, you know, a certain amount of sniping went on, but I also think a lot of people probably just took a breather.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think generally you see evidence of that.
Yeah. You know, it's going to be interesting. I mean, I know people on both sides, the Republican and Democratic sides, who will say the same story. The voter file's a mess. We haven't got people in key positions.
Right.
We're starting late. I mean, again, this is a bipartisan set of grievances.
A moment of bipartisanship in Texas.
Yeah, right.
The party apparatus on both sides are disrupted and in tatters.
And I think they're both right, by the way.
So, you know, we're going to run out of time. Let's go and do a little bit of a dealer's choice, as we often do. So let's go back and, you know, each of you, you know, tell me something that, you know, interested you in this poll that kind of spins out of this discussion. Darren, let's start with you, because I think you want to talk about something that kind of related to what we've been talking about anyway.
Oh, Josh, you want to?
Well, yeah, I'm going to follow up right on what you guys are talking about with mine.
Just jump right in,
Can
Josh,
I jump
that's
right
fine.
In?
Yeah, sure.
Do what I want. Well, I was going to say, I mean, Darren.
Do what you want.
Thanks, boss. So, I mean, Darren already mentioned this result, but I think it's one of those things, especially for this audience, just to highlight here, which is, you know, we asked a battery of questions like we usually do about a bunch of topics that are either in the news or fighting for attention or being pushed forward by key figures, to see how much people are hurrying about them as a way to kind of figure out if they're paying attention, if it's salient is the word we use, right? And I think we asked for about at least maybe 10 different issues. And the very, very bottom of the list in terms of what people had heard a lot about was the results of the runoff election in the district of Representative Dade Phelan, Speaker of the Texas House. Only 14% of voters said they'd heard a lot about this. Only 13% of Republicans, 7% of independents, 15% of Democrats. So this was just to put this at the very bottom of the list across every single group that we looked at. And it's just a reminder real quick that, you know, as much as these sort of internal politics are important and sort of royal, you know, us and our discussion and the people who are, you know, participants in the process, most voters, no idea this is going on, just not even on the radar.
Yeah. And then a state where, you know, there's not a ton of party competition.
Exactly. So, whatever. Anyway.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. And it was good for you to like just follow up.
I just wanted to highlight that one.
I was tempted to talk about some of the items we have on who do you think faces the most discrimination? Because there's as people might imagine, given the current political conversation with respect to Israel and Hamas, that we asked about the extent to which Jews and others too, but the number for Jewish people in the United States was pretty high, higher than I recall it being lately. So that I was tempted to go there, but instead I want to point people's attention to a small battery of questions that we asked about confidence in the election result and whether they personally will trust the election. And then another item that and I'll highlight it because I think it's fascinating and because I want to let the viewer into our world a little bit, which is, you know, our ambivalence about asking questions about political violence. it's really a tough item. So we asked, are you confident Americans will trust the result of the election? And the numbers in 2024 are actually pretty comparable to 2020. You could argue maybe even a little bit better. But 43% currently say they are either not very confident or not at all confident that Americans will trust the result of the election. So not quite half. That number is not unprecedented. We had similar numbers in 2020, but it's a disturbing number. It's a tough number. When asked about you, so not do you think other people, but will you trust the result? People basically said, well, not so sure. About a third said, you know, kind of don't know, unsure, which I always take as sort of a depends. But the number saying they would trust the result is 55%. In 2020, it was 41. So it's a 14-point uptick in the percent who said they trust the result. Now, I probably should have in advance of this looked at the crosstabs. My guess is it's Democrats.
It's all Democrats.
Who say like, so, I really trust the election given what happened in 2020.
So Democrats in 2020, 45% said they would trust the result. They personally would trust the results regardless of what happened. 44 were unsure. Today, it's 84% of Democrats say they will trust the results regardless. Among Republicans in October 2020, 39% said they would trust the results regardless. June 2024, it's down to 33%.
Yeah, which is unsurprising, but you know, and I do think that in the conversation, especially with people's recollections of January 6th and the problems there, I don't want to be a pessimist, but I would say, yes, January 6th has this, you know, infamous, you know, kind of reputation in American history, but let's not kid ourselves. If Donald Trump wins a razor-thin election and there are, you know, say, court cases about the polls not being left open long enough in Milwaukee or in Philadelphia, do we really think that there will be no protests, you know, for the certification of that election on the left? I mean, I think
I highlighted in our write-up, you know, another way to look at the result is what percent of people think it's not at all likely?
Yeah.
And it's minimal. I mean, across all groups, it's under 10%. Right. And that's the thing. I mean, to some extent, I think that's kind of what you pick up and you can kind of get stuck into the specific categories and how likely. Yeah. But the main point here is if you go around 9 in 10, you know, registered voters right now, you know, you think, so no violence after the election in America, right? And it's like, well, I don't know.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
And
go ahead, Darren.
Well, I was just going to say, and I'd point to the particular results where we're getting right now, 58% of people saying it is either somewhat or very likely that there will be violence. Mm-hmm. So almost 6 in 10 say they expect it's quite possible is what they're saying. And I would also not just the result I think is interesting and disturbing, but the question about our responsibility mm-hmm. in asking a question like that. Do we want to normalize that? Mm-hmm. If we find that result, it's a fascinating result. It's an important result. But what responsibility do we have as pollsters to tell people or perhaps not tell people that? And we're struggling with that. So we just wanted to...
Yeah, I wanted you to put some meat on like where you saw how you felt that ethical dilemma.
Yeah, I think the question is responsible. I think the results speak for themselves. I think I would rather know that and help shape the response than pretend it doesn't exist and be caught unawares or, you know, surprised when that kind of expression of public opinion is manifest after.
Yeah, and to put some meat on that further, I think the question that we're not asking just straight up is to say, you know, do you approve of political violence, or do you think political violence is justified sometimes, or things like that?
Or because, under what circumstances?
Under what circumstances, right. Whatever. Anything that sort of, again, you said, normalizes the use of political violence. I think, you know, the environment is such that, you know, and I'll say, you know, not even pointing fingers at any one party, it doesn't really matter. There are politicians out there who would take a result like that and use it as fodder for mobilization for very bad things. And so I think there is an ethical, you know, sort of boundary lines we have to follow here.
Yeah, I mean, I think, it, you know, like a lot of things that we do, it, you know, it's the degree, it's keeping in mind for ourselves the degree to which it's incumbent on us to explain it.
Mm-hmm.
And to explain it well and carefully, you know. You know, I'm going to go small in a way, or small and local in terms of what I really noticed. And you know, I was interested in the grid questions that we asked. And, you know, it's summer. And also, I mean, there's been, you know, this is one of those things. I mean, if we had put on, you know, our salience battery, how closely have you been following you know, hearings in the Texas legislature on the implementation of grid reliability improvements, you know, we'd have found more people paying attention to the speaker's race, even though that was all but nobody. But that said, there's been a lot in the air in the last few months. And I know, you know, based on our, you know, we know based on our previous, you know, polling in this area, you know, that you know, and I was thinking about this when you mentioned January 6th. I mean, the aftermath of Winter Storm Uri left a pretty deep impression, a deep and broad impression on people, I think, in that, you know, the experience was so widespread that, you know, so we asked people, you know, some of it, you know, was, you know, we asked people three items, you know, how likely do you think each of the following is this summer? You know, you'll be asked to conserve power. You'll experience rolling or temporary blackouts. Interesting question for Josh Blank this morning.
I lost power last night.
We lost his power last night during the storm.
It's fine.
Or the stormish.
I don't know.
Or do you think there'll be a widespread failure of the electric grid? Now, you know, it's a tribute to ERCOT messaging that, you know, 84% said it was very likely or somewhat likely that they'd be asked to conserve power. Now, ERCOT, it has already been very clear we're going to be doing this again. It's part of what we do. You know, went down about, 63% thought it was very likely or somewhat likely that they'd expect rolling or temporary blackouts. But to the point, about half, 51% said it was either very likely or somewhat likely that there would be a widespread failure of the electric grid this summer. Now, you know, I think if you're trying to say, hey, we're past this, let's not be alarmist, only 17% said it was very likely, 34% somewhat likely, and that's just hedging, and maybe, in some ways. But I think you have to, you know, I'm just struck by, for all the stuff we talk about politically, something that has been really durable and that I think the behavior in the legislature and the behavior of the state leadership illustrates that they know this, that, you know, people's trust in the electric grid was really eroded by that, and all the action on the part of the legislature, much of it well-intentioned and really, I mean, making a real effort to try to make the grid more reliable within the parameters of the legislature and their ability to do so in the interest group environment. Is still really kind of out there.
Trust is hard to rebuild, you know? I mean, I just, you know, we talked about this briefly, and I think this sort of relates to some other work that Darren and I did with the Texas Lyceum poll we released a little while back. And there is something out there that I'm just sort of noticing, which is, you know, we've talked a lot about the negative economic attitudes, you know, the fact that people's views of the Texas economy, you know, are more negative than we've seen historically, that we haven't really seen the rebound, you know, since the pandemic, really,
right.
You know, kind of to where we were pre-pandemic in terms of sort of just, you know, Texas bullishness. But then you see these other things too, which is like, well, how about the electric grid? And you see, you know, real lack of confidence there. You know, in the Lyceum poll, we asked about water reliability a little bit, and we asked people if they were concerned about the reliability or the safety of their water supply. And there we saw about 2/3 of adults saying that they were, and a third who'd said they already had, you know, sort of a boil water notice at some point in the last year. And I think these things, you know, you do wonder about the future of politics. You think about, you said, you know, if Donald Trump wins 2026, it's going to be tough. You think, what's the Democrats' messaging going to be besides Donald Trump? It's like, it's going to be this stuff. And they've been mobilizing this argument election after election, this idea of stewardship and whether they're taking care of the state. And you do, you see this floating around back, and this is just something that, like, you raise this, but, like, I think it's interesting. You're like, I'm watching this, you know, this sort of just basic functioning, how the state is being run for, like, you know, education, roads, electricity, you know, the infrastructure.
Yeah, I mean, it could have been like something else I wanted to talk about that we're not going to have time, but that, you know, we've talked in the last couple of times that we've had Darren with us, and we've come back to it, this notion of issue publics and, you know, the fight for agenda management in a campaign. But this is just something that's just sort of out there. And I think there was, you know, the O'Rourke campaign signaled in the gubernatorial race in 2022 that they were going to try this because of the relative recency of the grid failure. And it was the dog that didn't bark. So I don't want to overestimate the political force of this in this moment. But it just does feel like it's something that's trembling out there, and it's connected to a lot of these other, you know, infrastructure, you know, it's a little bit, it's both concrete in terms of this effect, but it's also gotten a little bit amorphous, this sense of, you know, tomorrow never knows, as we said before we started, that there's a sense of something kind of hanging out there that's not quite found us.
Yeah.
Well, that people are waiting for.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's a terrific article in The Economist about probably 5 years ago at this point, California versus Texas. And it was actually a really interesting sort of balanced account of which state was better positioned to deal with some of these fundamental issues. And they're both sort of quasi one party states. Yeah. And the Economist eventually comes down by saying Texas is probably slightly better, you know, positioned because it's not quite as, you know, there's not quite as much of a one party monopoly here as there is in California. And secondly, that California has overbuilt its government and has this huge bureaucracy. Texas has completely underbuilt its government. And that's probably, now it's not going to deal with issues, but that at least puts you in a position to, and I thought that was sort of an interesting and I think good self-critical.
Yeah, as I remember, I kind of remember that piece. And as I remember, it was kind of like, and that's been a benefit so far, but it.
Exactly.
Yeah,
but I do think, you know, look, count me amongst the people who says, yeah, somewhat likely grid failure, water problem.
I'm worried about water problems.
and I do think that it's, I don't know if the Democrats have done a particularly effective job at sort of laying the groundwork for these sorts of arguments. But look, there is a basic competence issue. And when you have had the keys to the car, like the Republicans have had since 1994, anything that happens along those lines, you own it lock, stock, and barrel. And I do think that's, you know, you look at the issue environment, and I think that's been the problem for the Democrats for years here, which is we talk about a potentially good year for Democrats, but it's kind of unclear where they have a big advantage over the Republicans in the state of Texas. You look at immigration, you look at, you know, energy, you look at the economy. It really does kind of skew right in terms of the basic opinion structure.
Yeah.
The sorts of things that Democrats need are things like health care, children's health care, stuff like that. But as you said, Jim, politics is dynamic.
Yeah.
And if stuff changes, and it could, and we as pollsters should really be attentive to the possibility. Yeah. Something that looks like a low incidence probability, that's exactly the kind of stuff that we need to be.
Low incidence, high impact.
Bingo.
Yeah. I mean, and, you know, just to round that out, I mean, just one last thing. I just want to say something. But it's like, I just want to say, I'm just thinking about it. I mean, you know, about the California-Texas thing is interesting because in one way, you know, the argument that, like, well, you guys did too much. I mean, that's hard, right? I mean, it's a little bit of a hard argument. Like, you guys have built this up. You know, you're doing too much to try to address these issues that we may or may not agree are issues, but some of us think they're issues. Whereas the idea that you didn't do enough or you haven't done anything to deal with these multiple issues, the problem there is in infrastructure, all those are like 5, 10, 20-year builds, right? There's nothing that, you know, you can't cut a check and say, okay, here's the check. Everybody gets a check in the mail, big signature on it. You know who did it, right? It's like, no, I'm going to make your traffic worse for 10 years so I can improve your traffic problem, right? Yeah. I'm going to shut your water off multiple days, you know, over the course of, you know, every quarter so we can replace all those pipes, right? So really it's experienced in a negative way. And, you know, what do you get to say? Like, just wait, it'll be great. And so I think I'd rather, you know, to that whole point, like, I'd rather be in the position of saying, hey, they're not doing enough and I'd want to, like, we want to come in and, and that's what Democrats are good at, right? Mm-hmm. Saying, we'll spend more, you know, on this infrastructure. So.
Well, and I, but, you know, and I would go back again to the 2022 example. You know, it's, you know, for Democrats to exploit that in Texas at this point, you know, things have to align kind of just right, given the configuration, just right in a wrong way, right? In other words, you have to have some kind of a fundamental event that shifts things or series of events that shifts public attention. But I think what we found in 2022 is that, you know, Beto O'Rourke could talk about stewardship all he wants from a power failure that was a year and a half before the election, and it just wasn't enough to overcome the organizational resource disadvantages and the issue agenda advantages that Republicans still had with Biden in the White House and immigration and border security.
Yeah, I think, broadly speaking, it boils down to incompetence and corruption.
It's good use of boils.
Yeah.
By the way.
It does boil, doesn't it? But it you need issues, you need events to, from a political point of view, to play in this notion that, you know, the party in charge is corrupt or the party in charge is incompetent. And I was a little surprised that, because both of those were out there a little bit in the aftermath of ERCOT, but it didn't really stick. And I think that's because there's a general sense that, well, but the economy's kind of bumping along. Republicans haven't really mismanaged the state. But as I think Josh suggests, maybe you too, Jim, that's always kind of lurking. There's that cynicism that Americans and Texans in particular have about their government. And the Republicans have been pretty fortunate, especially in this last 10 to 15-year run.
Yeah.
But that's not manna from heaven, right? I mean, a good economy and the lack of kind of acts of God, that can change on a dime and, you know.
And so as long as we're talking about comparisons and reading tips to close, I also want to point people to something. I don't know if I've sent this or flagged this for Josh yesterday. Great piece in The Atlantic right now by George Packer about Arizona as kind of a crucible for a lot of the issues we're talking about. The politics, the strain on infrastructure, you know, the consequences of long period of growth. Really, really, really great piece by George Packer. And if you're from Texas, it's hard not to, you know, make comparisons in a way in terms of the politics there. So with that, Josh, Darren, thank you both for being here. Thanks for the very thoughtful discussion, I thought. This was pretty good today, I thought. For what it's worth.
Don't be so surprised.
I'm not. And also for, you know, all your work on the poll for such a long time. Thanks again to our excellent production team of the Dev Studio and the College of Liberal Arts here at UT Austin. We're waving through the glass booth here. Thank you for listening. Make sure that you also go to the website. Lots more that we haven't talked about that we'll probably try to get back to. We'll be off next week because I'll be out of town, but we'll probably be back the week after, I think, if we can convene. You can find all the documents in toto, thousands of graphics that are free for downloading at texaspolitics.utexas.edu. So again, thanks for listening, and we'll be back in a couple weeks with another Second Reading podcast. The Second Reading podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.